ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Charlie Melcher, founder and director of The Future of Storytelling. Future of Storytelling is a passionate community of people from the worlds of media, technology, and communications who are exploring how storytelling is evolving in the digital age. Charlie is also the CEO of Melcher Media, an award-winning app developer, book producer, and branded content company that works with leading brands, media companies, and individual authors to help them tell their stories and connect with large audiences. Charlie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
When I was doing research about you, I discovered that you were behind the book S by J.J. Abrams and Doug Durst. And I have to say, that is perhaps my most favorite creation ever. And I was sort of just blown out of the water. I'm like, ooh, I get to talk to somebody who's involved in that. So that was sort of a tour de force of publishing and unlike anything I had ever seen. And I'm curious, how did that ever come to be? How did you do it?
Well, the original idea for that book comes from J.J. Abrams, and he had the initial thought that there'd be a book that would have handwriting in the margins. Mm-hmm. And J.J. brought Doug Durst on, and then he brought us on, and the three of us together, three teams, went about making this book. And I think we understood that there would be a novel very quickly, there'd be an underlying story, and that there'd be a relationship that was happening between two characters sort of on top of that story. Mm-hmm. And then the other really challenging part was to add that third layer of all of the artifacts and ephemera.
Right.
That would be a continuation and really allow the audience or the reader to have an active role. Right. That's what made the book immersive and three-dimensional, was that you were literally unfolding a napkin.
Right.
Or you were moving a dial with a number that you'd found in a footnote, or opening up a letter and finding a newspaper clipping of an obituary that's yellowed and aged with time. So the sense of wonder and excitement and personal physical participation was really added by that layer. I also think it made it feel that it was completely unique.
Yes.
People pick up that book and think, oh, this is the only one, right? I have the copy. And they don't realize that we ended up printing hundreds of thousands of copies of that book. But it was so authentic. And each of the artifacts and the way the book was distressed and aged, all of that made it feel unique, one of a kind, and intimate in the way that people are used to being with books.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to say, when I found the book in a library, and I felt like, this is amazing. I never want to return it. And I did eventually return it. But then I bought several copies and sent them to people as gifts, because I said, this is books. This is why books sort of are so amazing and so personal. And it really, I had created a documentary about a book artist, and one of the things that had been very frustrating for the book artist was the inability to mass produce some of the books that he was doing. And quite clearly, you cracked some of the problems that he had had in the early 80s. You have obviously overcome in being able to publish this amazing thing in a mass scale, but to still feel so unique and so special. So pretty amazing.
Well, thank you. And again, it was a team effort, but I will say that it represents, I love that you think of it as sort of a higher form of bookmaking, but to me, it really embodies a whole trend that I see happening in the world of storytelling across all media right now, which is this need for people to have an active participatory role in their stories.
Yes.
That the age of unidirectional and passive media is slowly coming to an end, being replaced by this age of two-way media, where people have an expectation to be able to participate, to co-author, to collaborate, to literally be, heroes in their own adventures.
Well, I think that what's interesting, though, is that it's exactly that, is that you're the hero. However, there still is a very strong creative voice. You know, you participate, but your participation, at least with that particular book, is at another level, so that you have coherence in the central story. And I think that that's one of the things I'd love to talk to you about in terms of when we think about sort of trends in storytelling and the whole idea of choosing your own adventure and programs. You know, various people are working on that as sort of for narrative, and your feelings about how much authorship. I mean, authors like to be authors because they like to tell their stories. And I think there's a willingness to include participants, but they still want to control a certain amount of story. I mean, is it still storytelling if you're surrendering to every reader?
So my thoughts about this is it's a little bit like learning how to ride a bicycle. When you first start, you really need to have training wheels or a tricycle. And so I think the audiences today are at that early stage where they are hungry to have a larger role, but they're not ready to go off on two wheels alone. There are only a few people who are really that experienced now at co-authorship, that they want a story that's that loose that they're basically building it themselves. Mm-hmm. So something like S does a good job of allowing some room, but still having a very strong narrative and a rail to bring people along. And then there are, you know, all the way at the other end, there are things where you just create an open story world,
right?
Like a LARP, a live action role-playing game, where there might be some rules set for the world, and maybe you're a character, but what happens after that is entirely up to you. And so we're finding those, we're evolving between these two places where it's complete chaos for you to create your own, and something that is just truly passive, and you have no role but to sit back and watch or listen. And I think over time, we're going to get more sophisticated, and audiences are going to demand more and more agency.
Well, what's interesting is the element of play that happens once. I'd never heard the term LARP, I have to say, but I love it, and I think I'm going to now use it. We had an interview earlier with a gentleman who's behind Secret Cinemas in the UK, and one of the things is very much this, where people who attend these events are assigned characters and roles, and it's involved with screening a film, but you have this very loose rule structure, and then everybody's improvising around it, and the sense of play mm-hmm. is so important. But what's interesting is that's what you're saying is coming on the way to storytelling, and that is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about this shift that the internet enabled, right? That's the world's first two-way mass media. Before that, there wasn't any other option. You had to sit back and just listen. Clay Shirky talks about this in his book, Cognitive Surplus, that the reason people were passive consumers is because the technology hadn't evolved yet to let them have a role. And as soon as it did, turns out people are hungry to be actively engaged in their stories. But the internet, what it did was allow the first wave of sort of social media where people could like and share and comment. But right. That's just the opening of Pandora's box. Now people are really looking to be able to, or at least some, are really looking to be able to have a much more active and multisensorial and participatory and immersive role. I actually came up with a term that I use for this, which is sensual media.
Ooh, I like that.
Media that is multisensorial, it's right. immersive, it's participatory, it's personalized, it has the ability to be social, and because of all those things, it can be so transformative to be really unforgettable. It's media that reminds you of the sensory joy of being alive.
That is fantastic. And I think that that's really when it's doing its job, when it's sort of our better angels and it's doing the best type of job. One of the things I'm curious about is obviously storytelling and story and the power of story has become a big buzzword. You can't go to a conference where brands aren't talking about their stories and authenticity. Those two things sort of hand in glove. And I guess, is there always a story? Do you really feel that there's always a place where story fits in?
So I am a big believer that stories are the programming language of the human species.
Okay.
They're how we learn about the world and make sense of it. From our earliest childhoods, when our parents would read us books before we could read, we were consuming stories. Now, there's plenty of information in the world that's not does not have a story to it. I mean, there's lots of data and facts that are not stories, but stories are information with emotion.
Right.
Stories are information that moves you to pay attention and to care. And that's why they're so impactful and powerful. And I do think in the marketing world, there's an understanding right now that when there's too much information, when we're awash in data, that it is stories that stand out. There are stories that get you to buy something or care about something or vote for someone. And so the age of just getting up there and screaming about how fast or cheap or powerful your product is just going to get lost in the noise. But if you can get somebody to feel and care and you know, want, then you're going to be successful. And that's by using stories.
Right. So you have the Future of Storytelling event. When did you start that?
Well, so the first one was 7 years ago in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been working on it for over a year before the first one. So I've been doing this for close to 9 years now.
Oh, wow. And how has it evolved since then? I mean, is it still largely structured the same, or if it isn't, what is the major shift that you're noticing?
So we went from being a one-day event for 300 people to a two-day event for 600. So those are some of the structural changes. But still, we resist getting very large because a huge part of our formula is the intimacy and the connections that are formed at FOST. We do a tremendous amount in the design of the event to get people talking to each other and constantly mixing up the groups so that you really have the opportunity to get to know people. And we do it in a very relaxed and casual atmosphere, so people's natural armor or apprehensions are let down. And so I feel the success of FOSS can be really measured in the interconnectivity, the connective tissue of the relationships that are formed there.
What would you say are the, coming out of the most recent FOSS, what would you say were the most striking trends? And also, have there been relationships or new things that have formed as a result of this past conference?
Yes. I mean, I get people all the time sending us notes saying, I was just amazed by the caliber and quality of the people I met there. I've made new best friends. I'm collaborating with people on new projects. So there's a ton of that.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of trends, I think one of my favorite things at FOSS this year was the one that won the FOSS Prize, which was a group from France called DV Group. And they had a piece called Horrifically Real Virtuality. And this was a mixed reality piece, which is really beautiful. The conceit is that Ed Wood, the infamous Hollywood filmmaker, is making a movie with Bela Lugosi. And you come in with five other people. It holds six people at a time. And you're engaged with these actors to help them film the last scene. And then you go into a movie theater, put on VR headsets, and you are now in the movie.
Oh,
and you
cool.
are now a CGI character interacting with the CGI Bela Lugosi in real time. And he's played by the character who's wearing a motion capture suit and a head rig that captures his facial expressions.
Oh my
but
God.
You're now able, it's literally like you're in a Pixar movie and you're one of the characters.
Oh my God.
And so to me, that's pretty exciting. That's a next generation of storytelling where, you know, I've always wanted to be in Toy Story. I want to be Buzz Lightyear. Okay, well, you know, we're going to have a movie where you're going to be Buzz Lightyear and interact with all these other characters. And it's going to be a little bit like being in Fabian Riggle's Secret Cinema, where there's a story going on, but you can play a role, or something like Punch Drunk, you know, Felix Barrett's immersive theater company that does Sleep No More.
Right.
Except that you're going to be a CGI character in a, you know, state-of-the-art quality movie.
So what is the name of this company that came up with it? I mean, this is fascinating. Who are they?
It's called DV Group, the letters D and V from Paris. And they're super talented. In fact, they had my favorite piece at FOSS the year before also, which is called Alice VR.
Oh, wow.
And there you play Alice.
And do they take this stuff on the road, or do they pilot it at your place? I mean, because something like that is so special, but it really does, it works because of the intimacy, to your point. And so...
Well, right now, the technology can only sort of handle 6 autonomous characters in this space at the same time.
Right.
And it's a 45-minute piece. So literally only about 100 people got to see it over the 2 days at FOST. So we've worked something out with the DV group where we're going to do a pop-up of it here in New York City.
Oh, I want in.
So that
I
it can be open. So, okay. We've got a ticket for you.
That is so interesting to really be able to participate and feel that. That's amazing. That obviously is tech being used to really immerse you in storytelling. Are there any other storytelling techniques which are more human, I guess, you know, that you see coming about?
Sure. I'll tell you a couple of my other favorites. So there's a company called Storyfile.
Okay.
It grew out of a team of people who worked at the USC Shoah Foundation.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Shoah Foundation, which was set up after Spielberg did Schindler's List.
Right.
And it was to record all the existing Holocaust survivors.
Right.
So a couple of years ago at the Future of Storytelling, that group brought a piece that was a hologram on the main stage of an 80-year-old Holocaust survivor named Pincus. And using artificial intelligence and natural language processing, they had filmed him answering so many questions. It was video, high-definition video, that you could go up to the microphone and ask Pincus any question, and he would answer in real time.
Oh, my God. That is amazing. That is so cool.
And it was super moving because people would say to him, you know, how old were you when you were taken to the camp? And when did you last see your family? And you would then listen to this articulate 80-year-old man tell you these moving stories about his life. And so that was very popular. We were very honored to have it at the Future of Storytelling. Well, the same group has now basically done a new version of this technology and created a version that works on a phone. And it's called Storyfile. And so you can use your phone to record somebody, so ask them questions with your phone and film them, and then save it, which is basically saving it to the cloud, to create a story file of the person you've interviewed, and then you can ask that story file any questions. And so to premiere this at the Future of Storytelling this year, they asked if I would be willing to spend time being interviewed. And so I went and spent 3 days in a studio in LA and answered over 500 questions as honestly as I could. And then they made a story file of me and they showed it on the main stage, and people in the audience could come up and ask me questions. And then they set it up as part of our story arcade. We have an exhibit, an interactive exhibit on campus, and people could literally sit down and have a conversation with me through the story file. But think about the potential. You wanted something human?
Yeah.
To record your grandmother, to record a loved one who has cancer, to just do it for yourself, for your grandchildren.
Well, that's amazing. And also in a sort of a more global way, imagine if you interviewed refugees and could take it around and really humanize global challenges that people are facing. It's so powerful. I'm curious, did you ask yourself questions and how did you feel about the answers that your hologram gave you?
Well, first of all, it has the 500 questions. And what it does is the words are all coded. So the program is able to look for keywords and then pull up that clip of video. So it's not creating new anything. It's just accessing a library of all the answers that I already made. And of course, these guys are very smart about knowing the kinds of questions people ask. But I will say, after 3 days and over 500 questions, it's exhausting. It feels like an inquisition. And many of the questions were incredibly personal. I mean, I broke into tears at one point with one line of questioning. And I did think twice about how honest I wanted to be. I mean, people who I don't know are going to now know things about me that only close friends so far have known about me.
Right.
And how comfortable was I about that? And what I realized was that I wanted to create this story file for my son and my unborn grandchildren.
Right.
And that this was an opportunity for me, not just for the FOSS community or for the StoryFile people, to have this record of me while I'm, you know, still alive and still have my faculties and can answer questions. But one thing it does do is it reminds you very quickly about how your life really is a series of stories you tell.
Right.
And that those stories come and go. So you depending on what questions were just asked, it helps your memory pull out other, you know, certain things. For example, they asked me to tell a story about my mother. I could come up with a great one. Then they asked me to tell a story about my sister. I couldn't think of anything. You know, anything that was really revealing or profound. And it's just like on the moment, you know, that night in bed, oh, I had a great one.
But
when you're there on the spot, you answer one way. If you had a cold cup of coffee instead of a hot cup of coffee in your hands, you'll answer different questions. So it just reminded me how fallible identity and memory and history really are, personal history. It made me want to do it over and over again. Like, I really, if I were going to do this, I'd say, let's listen to all 500 of those answers. And then let's go back and do it again if I didn't like some of the answers or I had another story I thought of. But with a story file, you'll be able to add to it because you can do it yourself of yourself.
Oh, so cool. When is that going to roll out? That's amazing. That's fascinating for public consumption. Because as you say, I mean, my father, I would love to have my father do this for my children, for their children, you know, before. Yeah.
I know. It's soon. I don't know what the exact date is, but it's soon. They'll be coming out with a beta version for people to use. Anyway, and then other technologies. I mean, there were some amazing holograms that we had, holographic technology. There's this cool company, Haptex, that has these gloves that you put on, and you put on a VR headset, and you pick up a snowball and it's freezing. Your hand is cold. And you put your hand down on a table and a spider walks across it and you can feel every leg touching your hand.
Oh, that's so cool.
It is incredible for moving us into this age of multi-sensorial, you know, but where we really just completely can trick the brain.
Well, what do you think of the sort of Ready Player One thing then? Is this where we're all going to enjoy our imaginary worlds better than our real life?
I think it's a really profound question for us moving forward. One of the things that I believe, and again, I'm a techno-optimist, is that a lot of these technologies are creating experiences that are more organically human, that are more appropriate to us as a species. You know, we're not meant to sit over a keyboard stretching our fingers out, typing, you know, in the basement for hours of a day. We're meant to be standing up and using our bodies and moving through the world and experiencing it. And a lot of today's technology or a lot of yesterday's technology had us sort of as passive, sitting at desks, sitting on couches, not really interacting in a natural way, using natural human interfaces. Mm-hmm. And looking at things like sensors that, for example, that came out originally in Kinect, Microsoft's Xbox Kinect, which are now going to be built into our everyday environment. Looking at interfaces that are oral, where we can speak to Siri or Alexa or whatever, you know, being able to use the way we normally interact with other people, gesture, you know, motion, all of these things are much more human as a way to interact with the digital age than what we've currently had. So in that way, I think we're going to enable us to actually go back to a kind of communication that was more part of who we were as an oral species before we even invented the alphabet, where gesture and facial expression and intonation and voice were the ways that we communicated. And then we became a literate culture, and the primary way of communication was the written word, and we stripped out so much of those human elements of facial recognition and voice and body language and all that stuff that's part of a discussion with somebody, which is, I've heard people say it's up to like 90% of the information you're getting from somebody when you're talking to them is nonverbal. Right. All of that got literally ripped out. I mean, Socrates actually described it as the written word as dead language.
Right.
And also because it was fixed and immutable. Right. Once you wrote it down, it was what it was. It was in stone. So now we're getting to technologies that are re-embodying us and allowing us to recapture all of that sort of unspoken and spoken language that should enable more empathetic understanding and communication.
Mm. Well, it's interesting because, of course, literature is its own art where you have sort of delicious word combinations. And do you see that still existing, continuing to exist, or going away? I mean,
totally.
I look at my children, and they are not big readers. They will read online, but they aren't the readers of a book, you know, and I love reading books. And different books are structured different ways. And part of it is actually the process of having this very private, you know, one-on-one relationship with the story and the book and the way the chapters are written. And that's just very different from consuming something on a screen. Do you see, I mean, generationally, do you think that literature will just go away, or do you think it'll always stay?
I don't think it'll go away. I mean, we still have debates and great orators, right? They just because the alphabet came didn't mean we gave up on the oral traditions. I don't think that the written traditions will disappear. I don't think, though, that this next generation or the next few generations will be as big long-form readers.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there will be a different way that they consume their information and their stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of media consumption has been so compartmentalized for so long. And that's because it all came out of these, you know, analog technologies. And you had to, like, devote yourself or your whole career to learning how to make a movie or to be able to cut an album or to put out a newspaper. And obviously now it's all available on everyone's phone. It's all democratized and easy to do and to share. And so I think we're moving towards an age where there'll be more fluidity and mixtures of media. And our stories will be told through mixed media.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean words will go away, but they'll be one of the elements. It might not be the only element. You know, in a book, for most books, it's the only element. It's 85,000 linear words. I think that we're going to go to different kinds of information and storytelling, which will be very rich. And by the way, also allow for different kinds of learners.
Right.
Not everybody was an alphabet mind, was a good reader. People are kinetic learners, you know, embodied learners, visual learners, auditory learners. So I think in a way it'll open the door for a lot more mastery of knowledge for different kinds of people. And you'll find what works for you and be able to go deep into that. But I don't think literature is going to go away. I think that's an art form that's wonderful and people will still appreciate it. Just like radio didn't get killed and then TV and film came. And so it'll have its place. It just might not be it won't be as dominant as a form.
Right. Okay. Well, I have one last question. We're actually run through our time, but one last kind of long question, I guess. So you had mentioned that you're a techno-optimist. And all of these things, I can see the wonderful upsides. If you were to put on your techno, I don't know, negativist or techno risk hat, what are things, I mean, you know, we always have to think when we think about new technology of ethical implications that, you know, like, for instance, how some of the social media has increased extremism, you know, which maybe people weren't really thinking about. It connects us all, but it can also go this other way. Are there any ethical things that people working with this technology should think about or we should be careful of as we approach this new way of telling stories?
There's no question. And I do believe that that it's all just tools and the tools can be used for good or for evil. So I think there's lots of things for us to be concerned about. I think that we have barely begun to scratch the surface of just how dangerous the loss of privacy is, and how we all gladly turn over everything, things we could have never imagined of handing over before in order to just, you know, have a little more ease of access on our phones.
Right,
and
right.
I think that's huge. And there's no question that that data and information being used by the wrong people is a very powerful tool for evil.
Right.
I mean, I used to say that we were in a golden age of storytelling and this was just a wonderful thing until I realized that politicians can use the power of those stories to deceive and manipulate us, right? It's propaganda. So I think that privacy is a huge one we have to be, I think we haven't yet come into the backlash over the loss of all of our privacy. And I think there will be a huge movement for consumers and individuals to regain total control of that privacy. or personal information. Mm-hmm. So that's one. I think artificial intelligence is something we have to be very conscious of, because there's no question that machines are going to be able to learn things very quickly.
Right.
And we need to be careful about, you know, what kinds of programs and tasks and fail safes that we put into these intelligent machines.
Right.
So there's no question that that's something we have to be aware of. You know, and ultimately another big moral issue is, I think, this issue of the digital divide. And we see it accelerating, where, you know, people with means have access to unimaginable wealth of information and learning.
Right.
People who don't are truly left behind.
Right.
To a level that's again, unprecedented in human history. And you can see that literally, like, from one district to the next in schools.
Right.
Where one has all the best technology and the other has like three crappy old computers that don't do anything. And that's just not acceptable.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things, one of the charities that we work with a lot is Donors Choose, which is a charity mm-hmm. for public schools. And it's heartbreaking. You know, they'll say, we'd like to X dollars for set of classroom dictionaries. We currently only have one dictionary and it's missing the letters L through Z. And you think, how...
You know, why are you using a dictionary? Right?
Well, but how can this even be? How can these children possibly, they're so set behind if they don't have these very basic tools. And obviously these are all public schools in high poverty areas. And you just think, wow, you know, it is not an even playing field. So it's interesting. And I'm glad you balanced out the amazing opportunity with the things we have to be mindful of. Because you're right. I think there are tools and there are good people and there are not so good people. And we all, you know, people will use those tools the way they will use them. So thank you so much for sharing everything. I have written down scads of notes to myself in terms of who I must find out more about these various things. And I feel like I could talk to you for ages.
Me too. Thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation. I feel like we just got started. Let's do another 2 hours.
Let's do another time, right? Exactly. Well, thank you so much. We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next. I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who've helped bring the program to life. First, my friend Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience. Thank you. I'll be talking to you again right here on Up Next.